My name is Brian Bonsenauer, and this session is entitled Patterns of Evolution. Where the session comes is in a series of sessions on the origin of the universe and kind of our place in the universe. This next week, I'll be sort of extending that a little bit, those ideas, and talking also about human creativity and the origin of the universe. So you can look for those sessions coming up in this next week. Please come up and join the circle here.
You'd rather have us facing this way? Is that okay? The face this way?
Yeah, this way's fine. All right. So I'd like to begin this session a little differently than some of the others with kind of getting your sense of that word evolution, kind of what that, it seems like that has different connotations for different people, different experiences for different people. So if you would just sort of take a minute and bring briefly to mind words, images, or stories that come to mind when you hear evolution, that word evolution. So think about what words, images, or brief stories might come to mind in that word evolution. So what comes out of that? Any thoughts on that? Yeah.
Well, to me, evolution is two people, which means a process of gradual change.
Okay.
I'm not going to use this board much.
Oh, we're not?
No.
I just want to throw some of these words up here for.
I think I always think about Darwin.
Okay.
The phrase survival.
Great. Darwin. Survival of the fittest.
Jay Gould would question that gradual change is probably being very rapid.
Okay, so gradual change, and then there's some new thinking about it, the idea of sort of rapid or sporadic change.
There's also the idea that when there are environmental pressures applied, that it makes those kinds of changes that you just listed.
So there's a sense in which these changes are in response to environmental pressures.
Yeah, and that's why there are the leaps. Otherwise, there wouldn't be survival when the changes happen in the environment.
Okay.
It seems too that there's always there is the process toward more sophistication.
Okay, so not just a process of gradual change, but an idea that being toward something.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated. It's more and more sophisticated. Whatever sophisticated means.
Kind of a question about that, what that word means.
And if there's change, then that kind of implies that it's also out of something and toward something.
Okay, so maybe toward something and away from something, or out of.
I think of the birth-death cycle.
Birth and death, very much involved with evolution.
A continuing process.
And it's continuing.
Seems like there's also ever greater diversification.
Okay. Okay, sophistication, diversification. And we talked a little bit about this in some other sessions, the idea of greater levels of diversity coming out in the universe.
But there's chemical commonness.
But out of a common place. So there's a sense, is that what you're saying? Is
it fundamental chemical steps that are in everything.
So there's, are you saying in that there's kind of like a common,
threads of
commonplace?
Common threads of chemistry.
More threads. Yeah, not just chemistry, but even morphology, what the body types are like. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, evolution's been going on ever since the boom. I mean,
okay.
That was.
So not just maybe that the idea of evolution is not just animals or plants and animals or living things, but an idea which was certainly what Darwin was focusing on. But in this kind of brainstorming about evolution, this continuing process of gradual or maybe rapid change is not necessarily about living things.
I mean, it's cosmological.
There's a sense in which the large scale structures of the universe are involved in this process as well. So maybe living and non-living.
And it's other than, I mean, it's more than just physical.
Okay, so I think that's well said, more than just physical.
And just as ontogeny repeats phylogeny, it happens in the individual. It's a repetition.
Okay, so there's a sense in which there's the individual.
Yeah, like the whole evolutionary biological process relives itself again in each individual from the process of...
There's some thinking along those lines, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And this, you know, you might say this is an individual, and part of what I want to talk about this evening is both the individual in our physiological makeup, but also in our emotional and spiritual journey, idea of evolution. Is there anyone kind of tied in or feel connected with some of the debates about evolution or feel yourself sort of, you know, kind of having fundamental questions with regard to evolution? I mean, with a sense of just trying to get a feel for sort of where people are at with that. One of the ways that debate has been phrased is creationism versus evolution. Is that familiar to people? Okay. So the focus of this talk, I don't really want to spend a lot of time sort of in debate of that, or in, I'd certainly be open to discussing questions or things about that and do the best I can. Answering questions about that. But I really want to focus on patterns of evolution. So kind of the foundation of what I want to do tonight in this session is to really assume, in a sense, a process of evolution, a process of something like a continuing changing process. Process that is involved in continuing change. Okay, this is a relatively new thing. For a long time in the history of humanity, the idea of how the world went was cyclical. Okay, the world went in cycles. The image of the universe was it's a place. Okay, it's a space, it's sort of fixed, and we sort of cycle through it, through summer, winter, day, night, all of those cycles that we're involved with. one of the reasons that Darwin was met with such resistance, and Darwin and Wallace with this understanding, was because of that sense. And cosmologically, this idea of living and non-living, that evolution takes place also on a cosmological scale, or with the origin of the universe, this was met with great resistance as well. And Einstein and some of the others who were working on this couldn't believe it themselves that this was what was happening. Okay, so even these brilliant thinkers trying to understand the nature of the universe, this is a real leap forward for them. So the religious side of it notwithstanding, I think it's no wonder that there's a great struggle with thinking about evolution and the process of evolution in our day today. I don't think that's unusual. Okay, any last sort of things you'd like to get up there about that?
It's not static.
Okay,
it is.
Not static, right, okay,
great.
Okay. One of the things I've been doing with these sessions has been using story as a way of talking about our understanding of the universe. And there's a book out, several of them out now. This is one of them called The Universe Story, that works to re-image or re-ground our scientific understanding of the origin of and development of the universe in story. All right? It's sort of a new idea, and something that I find very powerful and very useful, because inherent in a story is the openings for thinking about what the story means. Right? Woven into telling a story is hearing that story, thinking about how it applies to my life, what it means for my life, thinking about how it affects my relationships, both with people, with God, with the world around me. So to take what we understand from our scientific observations now over the past work of the scientific enterprise, and to re-image it as a story, I think is well overdue for us, because the understandings that are coming out of this scientific enterprise are in deep need of being grounded in meaning for us. And I think this is my own perception, but some of people's feeling of alienation from science and what that's all about is because it hasn't done a very good job of opening the doors for thinking about meaning. So the story, what it does is it opens those doors without necessarily saying this is what it means and you have to believe this is what it means. But it says, think about what this means, okay, using a story. So let me do that for you rather than just talk about that. Let me tell you this story, or part of this story. And with our focus on evolution tonight and patterns of evolution, I picked out a part of the story that deals with animals and plants, the sort of the evolution of this process, of the diversification, the sophistication, this movement, this process of gradual or sporadic change toward greater order. So if you just relax, sit back for a few minutes here, and listen to this story. Thank you. pure energy expanded, then splintered into a trillion galaxies, whose creativity brought forth at least one planet with a fourfold mode of action. A churning lithosphere, washed by the great gyres of the hydrosphere, evaporating into the billowing winds of the atmosphere, and all folded into the electrified intensities of the biosphere. Earth took its quantum of nuclear energy given by the supernova and created a cybernetic system that kept itself in rich metastability, on the edge of stability. A great ball dancing at the crest of a spraying fountain of water. In the center of such rich energy, life brought forth the wonders of the eukaryote cell, meiotic sexuality, ecosystem communities, and multicellular beings. A pervasive desire among the early animals is to increase in size. A larger animal can escape the rule of prey. Fewer of the early predators will feed on an animal that has grown beyond the size of their toothless mouths. From the other perspective, a predator who increases in size will be able to draw ever more of the life web into its feeding patterns. When life had, through long trial and error, established a functional multicellular creature, an Argus, such animals proliferated rapidly by entering the adventure of exploring the ocean at the end of the Proterozoic era. The animals grew and diversified to become the early jellyfish, sea pens, and flatworms of 600 million years ago, at the dividing time of the Proterozoic and the Phanerozoic eons. All such animals entered the visible scale, geologically speaking, overnight. As their expansion in size quickly met the upper limits inherent to cosmological dynamics. An animal that is too large, you see, will be too feeble to live vibrantly in Earth. For instance, a jellyfish is 100,000 times, five orders of magnitude, greater in size than one of its constituent cells. Thus, it has the size advantages for feeding on unicellular organisms. But if the jellyfish were to expand again two or more orders of magnitude, the electromagnetic bonds holding the cells together would not be strong enough to withstand even slight impacts. Its membranes would tear apart in even gentle ocean waves. Given the shape of a jellyfish, its functioning has an optimal size. This optimal size is established partially by Earth, in the sense of the dynamics of the biosphere and hydrosphere, and partially by the universe, in the sense of the strength of the fundamental interactions that were set in a self-sustaining form at the earliest symmetry break. The emerging animals at the start of the Phanerozoic strove to increase in size until they entered the range of their optimal existence. This range of the optimum for multicellular creatures is the mesocosm, a domain in between the microcosm of molecules and atoms, and the macrocosm of planets, galaxies, the sun. The The mesocosm is a realm with its own unique dynamics. If any creature from any phylum of Earth's life were to be expanded toward the dimensions of the Milky Way, or shrunken to the dimensions of helium, the creature would perish far, far before it reached either of those two realms. If the original flaring forth had been even slightly different, life's mesocosm would be vastly different. In that sense, then, the mesocosm can be understood as a specific, quantitatively particular possibility that has been set into the structures of the universe from the beginning. The invention of the mesocosm is an evocation of an adventure implicit in the early fire of the cosmos. So this story goes back a long ways. The story of the evolution of life as we know it on the planet Earth is deeply grounded in the cosmological evolution, the way the universe has come to be the way it is now. The size of the Earth, the amount of percentage of liquid water on the Earth, and the fundamental interactions that we've talked about in earlier sessions, gravity, the electromagnetic interaction, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force, are all inherent and at the root of the way that evolution happens, the way that we see this diversification and this gradual process of change in life. I wanted to point out three patterns of evolution, or three characteristics, three sort of ways of thinking about the large-scale structure of evolution that is coming out of the work of systems theorists and people thinking about evolution in its larger scale, particularly some of the work out of the Santa Fe Institute. A book by Stuart Kaufman has come out of there just recently called At Home in the Universe. It's a wonderful book. I don't think they have it over here. They do have this book over here in the bookstore, The Universe Story, which I just read from.
What's the title of the other one?
The title of the other one is called At Home in the Universe. Okay. And the author is Stuart Kaufman. And this is some of his work, and then some of it I want to expand on from my own experience and get some of your experiences in expanding on some of these ideas. But basically, there's three patterns or three levels that we want to outline in thinking about this arc of evolution. The first level is thinking about the evolution within a given population or a given species. Within or by a population. And this may be, and somewhat when you say evolution, or when someone says evolution to you, this may be kind of what you think about. Is, okay, so we have the brown moss, or the white moss, that are on the bark of the tree, and then the smoke from the coal power generating plant comes and colors the bark brown of the tree, and so the white moths kind of die out, and the brown moths, who were a much smaller percentage of the population, become dominant now because they're not, the birds can't see them as well, and so the white ones get eaten and the brown ones don't as fast. And so then the brown moths become the dominant moths in that population. So that would be an example of evolution within a population. And as you mentioned before, one of the ideas of thinking about evolution is that it seems to be kind of towards something, or from something to something else. This first level or pattern of evolution, we can talk about it being toward survivability. Okay. So the brown moths survive and the white moths don't in that example. The evolution of the population is toward survivability. And the mechanism that Darwin first and Wallace first elucidated or put down very forcefully was the idea of natural selection. That because of the environment, as was mentioned before, this change in the environment, the white moths now are not as well suited to that environment. They're not as fit. Sometimes that survival of the fittest. Well, fit here is a measure of their survivability. And since they don't survive as much, the brown moths then survive better. They become the dominant population. So the population moves toward survivability. That might be kind of the just what you think of as evolution. I mean, that's certainly, as I started looking into this, was my thought about what evolution was. It turns out in some of the thinking on this that you can layer this idea of evolution within a larger scope or within a larger pattern of evolution. So let's do that. The second level or layer in this arc of evolution is the evolution of habitats. And this is sometimes called co-evolution. Co-evolution. So this idea, I think first came out of, though I might, at least I first discovered it in some of the work by James Lovelock on the Gaia hypothesis. And the idea is basically that it's not just the environment changing and the animals or plants responding to that change. That certainly happens. But what also happens is that by their actions and by their surviving within the environment, these plants and animals change their environment. They change their environment to in radical ways sometimes. An example of that. In the early oceans of the Earth, the blue-green algae, which we still have with us today, was going about some of that merry business of turning the rich chemical food in the oceans into oxygen, right? Using sunlight to do that, transforming the hydrogen H2O molecules and releasing oxygen, okay? In the early lithosphere and hydrosphere there was no there was no place for that oxygen to go. There were no oxygen-breathing animals or plants. And so this oxygen just kept getting, you know, thrown out into the air and into the, absorbed into the rocks, absorbed into the water. And the level of oxygen kept rising, right? They can see this both in the geological structures of the time, the way that the oxygen interacts with different geological features. This level of oxygen keeps rising is equivalent to, for these blue-green algae, as the waste dump just kept getting higher and higher. I mean, we think of oxygen as this wonderful thing because it's very important to us in order to live. But for these blue-green algae, I mean, this is the waste. This is what they're throwing away, right? And nobody's recycling, basically.
It was toxic to the entire environment.
And it became, at a certain point, at a certain level, percentage of oxygen, became toxic, right? Above about 21% oxygen, things start to spontaneously combust. I mean, just, you know, if the percentage of oxygen in this room were at 50%, my arm could just burst into flame. Somewhat at random, based on just small changes in heat across that. And so this is a big problem, okay? You reach a point where you just can't live anymore with this level of oxygen. And so what happens then out of that is that these bacteria were changing their environment. And as a result of that, more evolution needed to occur. A different level of evolution occurred, different pattern here. So we have then the aerobic bacteria and the oxygen-breathing bacteria evolving in that situation to make use of this oxygen. But what's more is that the level of oxygen on the Earth today is stable at about 21%. And the mechanism or the way that that's kept stable, if it's a little bit more, remember things start to spontaneously combust. If it's a bit less, the partial pressure of oxygen is not enough to force oxygen into our hemoglobin. We would not be able to breathe on the Earth, and much as when you get to higher elevations, you can get short of breath and oxygen deprivation. So this percentage of oxygen is crucial to life on Earth as we know it. And the mechanism for keeping oxygen at this level is unknown. Some of the ways that oxygen is regulated in the environment, but the total mechanism for how oxygen stays at this level is unknown. It's supposed that through a process of evolution of plants and animals with their environment, we've come into this sustainable level of oxygen. That's sort of, in a nutshell, this Gaia hypothesis, is that there's some sense in which the plants and animals that are evolving interact dramatically and intimately with their environment to create, to create what? If evolution is toward something, what is this movement toward? What is this evolution toward? In the example I gave, in the early oceans, it was, well, toward survivability, certainly, because as oxygen became the waste product extraordinaire there that they just couldn't deal with, the evolution made it possible to survive of air-breathing or oxygen-breathing bacteria. But it seems like, and this is somewhat speculative at this point, It seems like that this evolution of habitats or co-evolution seems to be toward diversity or sustainability in that diversity. Let's see if I can write that. So what we see as these habitats evolve, we see a flourishing of diversity. Diversity happens, okay? And it seems like that this diversity is really, what's happening in that is it's providing a measure of sustainability. That if the, now if the environment changes a little bit, the glaciers move down, or the oxygen level rises a little bit, there's enough diversity of operation and activity and genetic information out there that it can stabilize that system much more easily. Okay, so a diverse, in that sense, a diverse ecosystem is more stable than a monoculture ecosystem or a monolithic ecosystem. Yeah.
Well, does it stabilize it, or do the diversity allow some of the species or whatever to survive when others might be wiped out by the change in the environment?
Yeah, well, that would be the thing is, okay, so it helps to stabilize it in this way that if the environment changes a bit, then some of the species survive. And this is what we see too in the fossil records of evolution. When there's a dramatic change, many of the species are wiped out. Some of them survive, and we sort of go back a notch, sort of go back to a very non-diverse fossil record, but one in which this becomes the primary pattern of evolution then, evolution within populations. And survivability becomes the key in that point. After time then, diversity again grows up to try and, again, somewhat speculative, but to try to form the most stable pattern. So that if those events occurs, seemingly life can move on and progress. Well, let me finish the last one, the last pattern here. So we've got the evolution within a population, the evolution of habitats, also called coevolution. The last one is the evolution of coevolution. And this seems to me, as far as I can tell, sort of Stuart Kaufman's own thesis. I find it interesting, so I sort of mention it here. These two, this one is pretty much accepted by everyone. This one is accepted by what seems to be a growing group of scientists and people thinking about evolution, though still somewhat controversial. This one is somewhat out there, okay? But I like it, and I'll tell you why in a minute here. The evolution of coevolution is the idea that it becomes, it sort of goes like this. If this level enables a greater chance that things will be survivable, mm-hmm. Okay? This level, this third level, enables a greater chance that things can diversify. So evolution is, so in other words, it's getting, when we go to coevolution, it's getting easier to survive, for life to survive. In this level, it's getting easier for life to diversify, okay?
When you mention that third level, do you mean on a macro level or a micro level?
Macro level. So, and this is, all of these are kind of macro level. This would be the smallest of those, or the microest of cells, I guess.
Just so I understand, coevolution is the diversity and stability that you're talking about?
Right, and so towards sustainability and diversity. And this one, this is my own term for it. Kaufman doesn't use this word, but I like to think of this one as toward livability. Okay. So it's there's some work that supports this. Some of the work that supports it says that looking at the fossil record and seeing that the longer a species survives, the less likely it is to die out. So the longer it's been around, the less likely it is to become extinct. But again, it's somewhat speculative, this sort of third level. Let me just take questions on that, and then I want to sort of maybe tie this in with thinking about our own lives and sort of some my reflection on evolution within my own life. Yeah, go ahead, Teek.
To me, intuitively, it feels to me like the third one is inevitable. If it isn't happening, and maybe there isn't enough evidence yet because it's still evolving into that, but it's inevitable. It seems to me, if you study the sciences and you see there's always process, there's always progress. Well, what else is going to happen in that particular dynamic? But then for that to develop, it seems to me. But another thing, when I've read about these things, they were, and you could elaborate on this, maybe you've been coming to it, that with like that using your analogy of the butterfly, or the sample of the butterfly, that if there is no brown butterfly and the white butterflies are being eaten, somehow there's a mechanism within the species that says we better produce a brown butterfly. Which is even more amazing that just having the brown butterfly and the white butterfly and the brown one happens to survive. But when the species somehow, then this is incredible, I think, that they've been able to establish that this happens, but it does. And that is that in certain circumstances they have shown where that species will actually produce itself a difference that it's never had before, in order to respond, and like it knows what it needs to do. I think that's incredible.
So, and some of the mechanisms here are, again, sort of the reason I think that some of these become less, more and more speculative, is the mechanisms become less and less clear why this happens or what's the driving force behind it. But what's starting to emerge and what Kaufman brings out is that there are more mechanisms, or he sort of categorizes them under one mechanism, sort of an overarching mechanism, in conjunction with natural selection. His point is that natural selection works to refine the population, but what he's tracing out with some of his work is a mechanism for creating these higher levels of order, for thing he calls order for free, which I'm not so sure I like that name, but again, kind of in this arc of these patterns that you can see, is kind of the pattern of that order developing out of this process. Yeah, Jack?
The nice thing about fossil records, I would assume, would be that it allows you to look at millions of years, right?
Right.
But it's also, it seems to me, that that would be the danger of fossil records, is that it allows you to look at millions of years, and maybe, I'm just wondering if there's a way in which the evolution of coevolution towards livability might show up in a fossil record, but might be betrayed by present trends in terms of the... if we were to put the last 100 years on a fossil map, it would look entirely different than it came before.
So yeah.
What's going on there?
I like that. Thank you for bringing that to the floor, too, because I think it's interesting useful maybe, I'm not sure how applicable or not it is, but I think it's useful too to think in terms this evolution idea on several levels. First, you can, you know, with the idea of the evolution of life on the planet Earth. Also in terms of our society, and where is our society, you know, how well are we doing evolution in from an evolutionary perspective? Survivability, okay, I think that's been kind of the goal for a long time. It may be becoming hard, that we may be getting thrown back to that, because I think we're really failing sort of here with moving toward diversity and sustainability. And, you know, I don't see this at all happening right now, sort of in our society, this toward livability. You know, it seems like we haven't even progressed much beyond this level. Yeah, fine.
It's interesting to hear you say that, I forget exactly your words, but you said, it seems like we're failing at the second level of diversity. Mm-hmm. Which, as a point, I wanted to bring up that we've kind of tried to take charge of evolution, mm-hmm. whereas we aren't really in charge of it.
Right. Right.
And we really control it, like when it's too cold, we build heaters instead of dying out or growing fur or something.
Right, you know? Right.
And
medical science.
And we have control, you know, yeah, and we, you know, we don't let the sick die, you know? Mm-hmm. And we control a lot of animals, too, mm-hmm. in their evolutionary mm-hmm. paths. And so that's...
Yeah.
Shifting the
balance. Right. Yeah. There was a talk earlier, a couple weeks ago, in terms of thinking about where our place, where we're at now, as between cultures of constraint. And I thought this was a very useful insight, is that the pre-industrial revolution was really a culture of constraint, more of a culture that was sort of driven by these same evolutionary processes going on. Right now, we've sort of pushed that off by making use of this energy stored in petroleum. Mm-hmm. We're sort of throwing constraint to the wind because we have this sort of abundance of stored energy, at least for the moment, that we can just say, you know, forget thinking about the way things should be. We'll just do it the way that we want to and just go on our merry way as long as the petroleum lasts, and then we'll be again in a culture of constraint. And so the point brought up in that talk was we need to start thinking about what culture of constraint might be like, because we may be coming to the end of our ability to put that off any longer. Yeah.
I'm a little confused here on the term progress. Mm. Are you using it interchangeably with change? Or are you
no.
using it in a different... I'm confused about that. The difference between change and progress. Is that a distinction between progress is therefore always good and change simply is? Or?
Let's see. I might have a quote here that I can... The my sense of the distinction there is progress is moving towards something and from something else, and change may just be, you know, maybe cyclical or maybe just not going sort of in any direction. Let's see. This is a wonderful book on meditations with Teilhard de Chardin. One of the first real. Prophetic sort of speakers toward thinking about evolution in terms of Christianity. And there's also a book in the bookstore by him that's called Evolution and Christianity, which is an interesting book if you have an interest in that. Here's this quote. Chardin says, phenomenally speaking, we see the world not merely as a system that is in movement or in change, but one that is in a state of genesis. And that idea of genesis being creating these higher and higher levels of order, much as in the story of Genesis, where you start out with the void and you end up with creation. So that would be my sense in the difference between progress and change, but I'm not sure the context that you were referring to, so I'm...
Well, I guess I was kind of asking whether you were ending up with the omega point of Chardin. You end up with nothing. I've never quite figured that
out. Right. No, my thinking on this has been very much influenced by Chardin and Thomas Berry, who has kind of picked up some of the ideas that Chardin was working with. Let me just say one last thing about this then, is as well as thinking about this in terms of the arc of evolution of life and in terms of maybe our society, I think it's useful for me to think about this in my own life, my own evolution and journey. And it's certainly been helpful for me to use a framework like this, and it may be helpful for you. Just to kind of give you an example of that, sort of this first level I see sort of happening in my life, it's kind of the survivability level, you know, how to win friends and influence people. Ideas, you know, how to get by in the world, my survival skills, basically, for dealing with the world. The second kind of level or pattern, this kind of an opening up in my life to a greater variety of experiences and ways of thinking about things. And sometimes when I'm under stress, I sort of fall back into the survivability mode. But generally, if I can kind of keep grounded and going, sort of open up to listening to new ideas, even when they challenge my fundamental assumptions. Jack's been doing a great series this last week on the historical Jesus and sort of that challenging of some basic assumptions in certain situations, I can remain open to that and hopefully move toward greater sustainability of my understandings of the way things work there. And then the last level, which I hope to get to someday, it seems to me to be sort of not just welcoming new ideas or diversity, but really supporting that and working in my life to engender that in other people and in communities of people. So, you know, I would just like to get in the last 5 or 7 minutes here some of your thinking about these patterns of evolution within your own life. Does this model seem to work for you? Does it have... is it helpful for you in reflecting on your own life, your own journey, your own evolution? And maybe just, it seems like this would be done best within some small groups to kind of talk about this and think about this. So maybe get into groups of 3 or 4 or 2 and just kind of talk about, do you see these patterns within your own experience? How might these be helpful for you in thinking about that? So maybe a group of 4 there.
A model for personal development.
Yeah, I would say that's what I was doing at the end there, was using these patterns of evolution to think about my own personal development. Now, and maybe they don't apply, you know. Maybe they don't apply. It's not that... that evolution has to be recapitulated in my own personal development. But what I'm seeing, reflecting on these patterns of evolution, that people are drawing from fossil records, I think they have things to say about both my own personal development and the development of our society. So I would agree that using evolution and patterns of development and saying, how does one apply to the other? yeah, thank you. This group here, I think, particular, come up?
We weren't exactly sure of the assignment either.
Okay.
This was helpful. We were kind of talking here whether you wanted to see the development of the individual kind of retracing the old ontogeny, recapitulating phylogeny, mm-hmm. the development of the species. When we realize that there are certain things that we do that we can't help the effect it has on the environment, but there are other things that we can do that we can control very much mm-hmm. what effect it has on our environment and therefore how much impact it has on other all other creatures. We didn't get a chance to talk too much. I was more interested in finding what you had said yesterday.
I see, okay. Well, those tapes are available. Anything to add to that before we break down and go to Vespers?
You know, the only comment I made was that my thinking on evolution was more from the physical standpoint, mm-hmm. the evolution of the universe and the evolution of the Earth, the gradual changes in landforms, right. the geological things, plus the animal changes and so on. But
right.
your approach to that, of course, adds this deal of looking at it from the human standpoint,
mm-hmm.
for individual.
Right. Okay, thank you. Let me just leave you with this other meditation from Chardin. It is in the direction of the fullest that the truth lies.